Hello, welcome to The Addict's Advocate, a podcast geared towards the suffering addict and those in recovery. This podcast does not provide any medical advice. No material on this podcast is intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare professional with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen. And never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you have heard on this podcast. Enjoy the show. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Addict's Advocate. I'm your host, Dusty Dean, and it is my pleasure to introduce a good friend of mine by the name of Cheryl. How are you doing, Cheryl?
Hi, I'm Cheryl, and I'm doing great today. It's a beautiful day outside. Cold, but pretty. Very nice.
Yeah, no, same as on my end. But I appreciate you spending the time in your afternoon here to go over your story, because I think your story is very powerful. You've had some trials and tribulations going through it. Obviously, the catalyst that got the addiction out of hand is something that I think is important to share as well. And, you know, life gets in the way, and sometimes it's difficult to cope with trauma, loss, all those things. And so I feel like your story is very powerful, and I think it will resonate with a lot of people.
Oh, well, I hope I can help. I know I certainly learned that life can throw you curveballs, and what you expect is going to happen is could happen or maybe won't happen. So,
yeah, no, I hear you. You know, I'm going to go ahead and let you just take it from here. Why don't you go ahead and give the audience a little background on yourself and how you got to this place in life?
Okay. Well, my name is Cheryl. I am looking forward to a big birthday in August. I'm going to be 60 years old. I grew up in Charlotte, North Carolina, and I was an only child. I am an only child. And neither one of my parents drank, so I didn't come from that kind of background. That was not a part of something I saw regularly. We really only had one person in our extended family. The reason why I'm talking about that is the gene. Talk about the alcoholic gene, but we only had one person, which was my maternal grandfather. He was an alcoholic, but other than that, nobody else, you know, kind of leaned into that. I had my first drink when I was about 12 years old, and that was simply because I was curious. I just sneaked into my parents' cupboard, and I don't even know what it was, but I think it was something really stupid like vermouth. I was just curious because it was a bottle that I, you know, wasn't allowed to drink from. So I decided to do that. Then as a teenager and a young adult, I did drink socially. Turns out, as I look back quite a bit, that's what we did in the South. That's what we did during that. And that would have been like, let's see, if I was born in 64. So we're looking at like 1980, you know. 80s, 90s. It was just, you know, people always had alcohol at parties and stuff. So I did that. And I'm looking at notes because I looked at some of this stuff earlier. So I drank as a young person, but I never used it as a coping mechanism. That I want to make clear, because looking back on my teen years and my young adult years, and then on up before I became, you know, truly deep into alcoholism, it was for fun. It was because other people did it. It was because it was a party. It was a barbecue. It was something, you know, it wasn't to put out pain. It wasn't dealing with trauma. That didn't happen until much later. But as I look back at it, especially after I had children and the mommy groups started getting together and we started doing those lunches where one glass turned into two, or sometimes the mommies would convince me that, hey, Chardonnay has too much sugar, so you ought to be drinking vodka. When I look back on that, I can see now that it was ramping, but I would never have known it at the time. I was in very deep denial that that was going somewhere because I could stop when I wanted to stop. It's no problem. If I didn't want that drink, I just put it down. But it was just always there, so I always did it. And I started to notice, Dustin, that every 6 weeks when it was time for me to get my hair done, because we get our hair colored every 6 weeks, I would kind of have a hangover and I wouldn't want to go do my hair. And I'd be like, wait a minute, every 6 weeks you're in this hangover state? So that was my barometer at first. And then it was Christmas trees. Every time Christmas rolled around, I'd be like, I'm hungover again. Oh no, why every time there's a Christmas tree and it's time to get my hair done, this is something is going on, you know, it's too much. So it was slowly sinking in, but still I was in denial. And people can be in denial for a long time. They can fool themselves and trick themselves and tell themselves all sorts of stories and believe it, because you wouldn't have convinced me I was an alcoholic. But I would say at that point I was a fledgling, you know. It was certainly too much. It's certainly not healthy. Now we know women are supposed to have not more than one drink a day, if that. That's what, you know, is considered, you know, a healthy normal for women. So that went on till 2020. And then that is when actually all hell broke loose in 2020 for everybody. COVID hit. We were having to shelter in place. I have a special needs son that grew to be very large. He's 6'5", 250 pounds at the time. And I was sheltering in place with him and having to make him go to Zoom school. That was very difficult. He has autism. So he was not the easy kid. He was rough. He was rough on me. So of course, that's an excuse at the end of the day. Let's just drink. You've had a hard day. You've gotten through that situation with him. Now let's unwind. And then my husband, after 25 years, decided to take a different path. And then that was the biggest curveball of my entire life. And to this day, 4 years later, I'm still working on myself so that I can be a better person going through this divorce. I simply started using it to cope. The pain was very, very severe. I should mention, I also have a daughter who, she is 26 now. She has lifestyle ish, not, I don't want to say issues. That's not the right word. She has lifestyle differences. So she is transgendering. And then, so I have a different son and a different daughter than some people have, and a husband who left. And, so there I was, in the in just straight up grief. I was just so grief. I didn't mean to drink and get out of control, but what I noticed, I was so sad that if I drank a little bit, I became a little bit more functional. At first, it actually did help me cope. I was able to interact with people. Of course, I was wearing a mask at all times, wearing that mask. And when the mask came off and when I was with nobody, I would drink and cry. And drink and sleep and drink and cry and drink and sleep. And I remember one time somebody calling me and saying, are you doing okay? And I made a joke out of it. And I said, yeah, I'm doing great. As long as I'm drunk. Still didn't get it. Didn't know I was heading down this rabbit hole. And then time went by. And about 5 months after that, I got breast cancer. So now you're adding a bunch of trauma things. I'm pretty sure I have PTSD from raising an autistic son. I won't even go into the kinds of things I dealt with him, but to say the least, it was not an easy thing that most people don't have to do that with their children, you know? But I, you know, we couldn't easily even go to the movies for fear he would throw popcorn, Coke straight up in the air, stuff like that, rocks through windows. And then, you know, and then there's my daughter going through her time of life and times of changes. And then there's my husband who leaves. And then there's me getting sick. And it all just came down. And then it got where it took a little more vodka to feel that better, a little bit better, you know, a little bit more. My tolerance was getting higher and higher and higher until I was just flat out drunk most days. And then the worst thing of all happened to me that I regret this with my whole heart is that all of my passion and sadness and rage started coming out. The alcohol flipped on me. So I stopped functioning. It didn't help me interact with people. All it made me do was get drunk and get mad. And that's when my own violence started coming out. And I'm still paying for that. I'm still paying for, you know, medical bills, threw a remote and hit the TV, broke the TV. I've got to buy a new TV. I've had to go in an ambulance twice because when I tried to stop drinking, I started having seizures, which I'd like to speak to that a little bit too. But that was the worst part of it for me, is knowing that during a blackout, I hurt people that I love. So I'm not waiting until step whatever to make amends. I do participate some in AA, but I'm making amends all the time. I just saw my daughter for the first time the other day, and it went really well. She was sitting on the floor, and I was sitting on her bed, and I made the most sincerest apology that I knew how to make. And she crawled on her hands and knees and put her head in my lap. So I think I'm forgiven, because I know I spewed a lot of nasty, under the influence. So that's the part I really, one of my big, big regrets. And I was in a blackout. Don't even know what I said. All I know is I did something real bad because people stopped talking to me. So going back to detoxing, if you're seeing this and listening to this, and if you're considering, coming off of alcohol and you've been drinking for a while, don't do it alone. Don't stop cold turkey. I didn't know about this. I didn't know. I'd heard people say you could get DTs. I mildly knew what that was, but I didn't know what a seizure was. And what happened to me is I went 48 hours without alcohol, and I started to feel flickery. I was standing up in the bathroom, holding onto the wall, because it felt sort of like this, like flickery lights, like, and a little off balance. But I didn't know what it was. So I thought, well, that's weird. So I walked to the top of my staircase, and my boyfriend was going down the staircase to turn the lights off. And he said, I dropped like stone. And I went down the stairs head first on my back. So my head took the staircase, bumpity bump. So out of that was an ambulance ride to the hospital, a concussion, two black eyes. I have pictures where I'm just black all the way across. They watched me for a certain amount of hours. I don't know why they sent me home, but they did. Big mistake, because 12 hours later, my eyes rolled back in my head and I fell off my bed and seized again, back into the ambulance, back to the trauma center. And just the ambulance ride alone has cost me over $5,000. So this is why I say, if you're feeling like you need help and you want to get off, you can do medical detox. You can use your insurance. If you have health insurance, find a detox center that takes it. Let them help you through it. They use medications like Ativan, sometimes Valium. What that does is it slows the brain down. Your brain is used to, you've given your brain so much alcohol for so long that it's stimulated. It's stimulated, stimulated. You take it away and it kind of freaks out. Your brain waves are acting different, but the Valium and the Ativan will slow that down. It'll take it down and they'll watch you and you'll be safe. And then time will pass and you can go forward from there. But I just, after going through something like that, I just really want to urge people not to try to do it by themselves. You can die. You can knock your head. You can fall and hit your head on something, or the seizure itself can kill you. So we did ask doctors if it is an automatic emergency room situation. They said it is not automatic. If the person comes around quickly and is not too disoriented, you can manage it at home, or you can drive them. You don't have to put them in an ambulance. You can avoid that step. You can take them in a car. I was completely, I was gone. So I think my boyfriend did the right thing in getting me there, but it was expensive and pretty horrible.
You have a lot of things here that I'd like to touch on. Number one, yes, I think addiction genes can skip a generation, right? If your immediate family didn't have any experience with an addiction of some sort, but your grandparents did. I mean, my mom never had a problem. My biological father did, but I didn't meet him for a good 30 years. So it wasn't environmental in that way. But my grandparents on my mom's side were heavy drinkers. And my, like I said, my biological father, who I didn't meet till I was in my 30s, he had a heroin addiction. So I definitely had kind of like the genes from both sides. You touched up on trauma, and unfortunately, right, with life, we don't get to choose when our trauma comes, and sometimes it comes all at once, right? You mentioned the divorce, you mentioned the cancer, obviously the difficulties in raising children whom don't fit that whatever normal means anymore. And so it's sometimes it's a lot to process, right? There was no rest there to grieve one thing and move on to the next and, you know, or be able to work, you know, in a silo without all the extraneous circumstances in your life. And you're right. You know, getting sober can be dangerous if it's not done right, right? Just as much as not getting sober is very dangerous. So I'm thankful that you were able to get out, you know, get good help and was able to recognize the things that, was going on with you and you had the best assistance. It sounds like, I mean, I know because you and I were together in a place that I felt was a lifesaver for me. Silicon Valley Recovery was a lifesaver for me without a doubt, because I was struggling as well. It was, you know, a month before I admitted myself into SVR, I basically took myself into the ER and said, I don't want to leave until I get this figured out. And I met with a psychiatrist. I met with a psychologist. I got clean, went home, and I proceeded to have like 12 benders in a matter of like 20 days. And the help wasn't intense enough. And I was so far gone that, you know, I knew in my heart of hearts, this is probably going to kill me. And if not, I may inadvertently kill somebody else because of my actions and my habits. So, so the seizures obviously were probably the biggest catalyst for you to go and seek help.
Yes. And my boyfriend who was living with me, then and now, he was the one who found the help. That was one of your questions. How did I, you know, learn to get help, or where did I get it, or whatever, something like that. But, my boyfriend was with me, and he was visiting a friend at Silicon Valley Recovery. And he went to one of the counselors who happened to be walking by, and he said, can you help us? My girlfriend needs help. We need help. So that's how I entered that rehab. And I learned so much. I was there for 40 days, got completely clean. And weirdly, I didn't have any problems there, I guess, seizing because I was on the Ativan or whatever. But I came around so fast, they were shocked. They gave me 10 days to detox. I didn't stay in bed one day. The very first day, I got up and went to all those classes, like, you know, 6 hours of classes or whatever it was. I just dove right in there. I don't know how I didn't feel more miserable, but I just did that. And I learned a lot. I learned a lot through the private sessions and a lot through the group sessions, and was introduced to AA for the first time. And I will say it was listening to people's stories at AA that really hooked me. Because about 8 days into that, I remember going into the office and saying, I think I'm going to leave. I don't even know if I want to be alcohol free. This is not me. I don't know if I want this for myself. I wasn't fully convinced yet. And then I went back and listened to some more testimonials that were coming through that garage through AA. And those people's stories really kind of got the hook, placed that hook good and deep. And I realized, yeah, I'm one of them. So I did that, and I learned so much, and I really love that place. And, I know, unfortunately, one of our women did not make it out of that group. And I'm not going to say who that is, but I would like to just mention it, because I didn't know that was a possibility. I was so shocked. I was so shocked. When I came out of SVR, it was close enough to the holidays that I relapsed, and I knew I relapsed, and I knew not to do it alone. So I put myself in this place called Heartwood Detox Center. It is really beautiful. If anyone is listening and needs a detox center, check it out. It take books, because the first time I was there, I remember making a joke. It's a beautiful morgue. It is so quiet because all people do is get off their drugs and they sleep. So unless you have someone to talk to, take books or, you know, listen to your stuff. But It has beautiful fireplaces, very nice doctors and, you know, the care team. And so I went there. But anyway, long story short, I got up on Thanksgiving morning to a text message from my friend's husband. And it just said, terrible news. So-and-so passed away last night in her sleep. And I couldn't have been more shocked. I didn't know that people just all of a sudden died from it. And they never got back to me. He said he was going to, like, you know, do an oncology report and let me know, but he never did. And I didn't want to bother him. But what I think happened is her resistance had lowered while she was in rehab. And this bears mentioning too, if you do come off of it, and then you're off for 30 or 40 days like I was, and then you slip up and let's say you relapse, your resistance is down. So I think she relapsed and accidentally I don't think she was trying to kill herself. I think her body couldn't handle it, and she drank like she used to drink, not knowing any better. And that one, she didn't know that last sip would be the last. That's the thing about it. You don't know which sip is the last sip. So just something else to, think. Not fun to think about, but important too.
What do you think your biggest mistake was that led you to a relapse?
Well, I'm looking at my notes. Let me see. I can tell you one that comes to mind right away, but let me make sure I'm not missing anything. I think not following through on aftercare. That was huge because I didn't quite believe the cucumber story. And most all of us addicts know the cucumber story, but if you're listening and you don't know it, it means you are once a cucumber and you drink so much that you become a pickle. And once you're a pickle, you can't go back to being a cucumber, meaning you can't reset. If you think you can, well, I convinced myself I wasn't an alcoholic. I even joked about it to my counselor, scared her to death. I said, I'm no alcoholic. I was just drunk for a minute. She said, how long was the minute? And I said, 3 years. So she said, you're a pickle. I said, well, I don't know. I think I'm a cucumber. So I didn't follow through with my aftercare and thought that, I had all of this psychoanalysis. I wasn't quite so heartbroken. I was still heartbroken over my divorce. Maybe I always will be. But I thought I was learning to sit in that pain easier, because that's something you have to practice. My mom always asks me, whenever I list up the things that I told you, the children, the sheltering in place, the breast cancer, the divorce, she says, why is divorce always the one that's, the most important thing out of all of those things? And I always say, because that's the one that hurt me the most. I was in so much emotional pain. I couldn't stand to breathe. I hated when I would wake up. Most people are grateful when they wake up. My dad used to always say, every day above ground is a good day. I used to say, I'd wake up and go, God, not this shit again. I was there. So that's, but your question was, what led me to relapse? So I went through this rehab, didn't do the aftercare. Thought I'd had enough counseling that I didn't quite hurt quite so bad. One little sip over time leads to two little sips over time. It just led back into it. And then when I got enough into my system, the rage came back, all the anger towards the ex. And then I just started getting very, very out of control to the point that legal got into it. Now I've got legal issues over it. Been arrested, gone to jail, been strip searched, whole nine yards. Got to pay for that. That's because I lipped off at a female officer. I got violent. All the things a person would be disgraced over. And so after those episodes started again, my boyfriend once again stepped in. He found another place, and this one was called Mountain Vista Farms. Highly recommend that too. It is not fancy. if you're able to pack for yourself, if you're not drunk while you're packing, pack as though you're going to a camp, like, you know, like a kid's camp, just like that. Cozies, take your cozies. And it's up in the mountains, lots of rain and fog and all that. But the group sessions, again, phenomenal. The AA sessions were phenomenal. You do have to start each group session with the Serenity Prayer. I don't know what my higher power is. I don't know what God is. I said that Serenity Prayer so many times that all of a sudden I realized I was more serene. And that made me realize that I was actually meditating as I was praying. You know, so call it what you want, prayer, meditation, or whatever. But when you have a mantra that you repeat like that over and over, it, for me, it did sink in. And I became more serene. And I started to realize I want to be a better person. And lots of, got more group therapy there than individual. Whereas at SVR, it was probably about the same. So both of those are very worthwhile places. And then I came out and I am now in aftercare and it's across the street from my house. I can walk and they offer it to me literally 5 mornings a week. And then they have it 2 evenings a week. So I go as much as I want. I go there now instead of AA. I'm not quite ready for sponsorship or leading someone else or, you know, taking on 12 steps. But also for people who are listening and may not know this, there's Smart Recovery. There's Dharma, and I believe there's another one, there's another 12-step program. So if you want this type of 12 steps, but maybe you don't want the religious aspect of it, there's others out there. The Smart Recovery leans more towards the Eastern ways of thinking, and that's Dharma. Sorry. Smart Recovery is more science. That's the science base. It's Dharma. That's more the Eastern philosophies. So yeah,
you had brought up a couple more good points here. I want to touch base with you on it. Number one, sometimes triggers are really weird, right? And I think that being afraid of the label alcoholic can be a trigger, right? Because what we end up doing is we say, "Hey, I'm not an alcoholic. Watch, I can control my booze." And we set ourselves up for a trap inevitably. So it's a form of trying to test ourselves. I've gotten used to this word of addict and alcoholic. And because again, it's something that we're dealing with. It's not defining who we are, right? Just like the diabetic, right? We don't tell a diabetic, they don't say I am diabetes, right? They say I have diabetes, right? You know, I have this thing. It's not what I am. It's just something that's a disorder that I'm struggling with. So I think, you know, removing yourself from those labels and those words, just recognizing that's all they are is just words. And unfortunately, you can't control how people perceive them. But you know in your heart, right? I mean, being on this side of the coin, recognizing what is alcoholism truly, and that, you know, it's a disease and it's cunning and baffling and it's powerful. But I do think also, you know, moving forward in life, what I found interesting for me was that when I gave my 30-day, the coin out that night, and I gave my talk, I realized that I was struggling to keep it contained within 25 minutes because so many things in life were really heavy to me. You know, loss of a daughter, loss of a father immediately. I lost a couple of businesses. You know, a lot of these things were traumatizing to me too. And they were so heavy in my heart that that's one of the reasons why I used. So coming off of the addiction and 30 days in, it was all that emotion was still there, but I had no way to deal with it. So I usually just vented it. I tried to converse about it. But the irony was that as time went on and I managed that, those feelings, and I managed dealing with that trauma and, you know, counseling, therapy, et cetera. When I did a talk for SVR's alumni meeting one night on a Thursday, and I was struggling to give 15 minutes worth of insight into my life because the weight of all that because I'd processed it all, it became so much lighter. And so that's kind of a godsend. So I'm hoping that for you that as you continue to process all these things, that the weight of them isn't as great. And yes, you are right. You know, there are a ton of options with recovery. I'm in the same boat. I go to an NA meeting. I'm still in an aftercare program. And actually, some of the gentlemen that I'm in aftercare with, we're doing our own thing on Monday nights now, where we're getting together for coffee and talking about our week and just being connected and, you know, with addictions of all different sorts that they're in recovery for. And so I've put less weight on me having to feel like I need to start this 12-step process, because I don't want to set myself up for failure, number one. I don't know how deep down that rabbit hole I want to go. I do feel like I'm personally a spiritual person. I've done a lot of reconciliation with people in my life. And I know that there are different ways to recover, right? And I think you hit the nail on the head, right? There are a lot of different options on how we can go about, you know, feeling connected, you know. And I think one of the biggest things about maintaining sobriety is that community, though. And I think that those things obviously are vessels, right? AA is a vessel, NA is a vessel, Life Ring, Dharma, all these places are vessels in which people with the similar struggle can get together and share and feel connected, right? And so I always encourage people to not only that, but get your own group of sober community, create your own, right? Stay connected, have a text thread with them. You know, talk to them on the phone every once in a while, check in, right? Keep yourself accountable. And I think that's one of the biggest things, right? Because as alcoholics and any sort of addiction, we isolate, right? We remove ourselves from things. We don't want to deal with the pain. We just want to numb the pain. And whereas, you know, sobriety is the opposite of isolation, right? It's community. You know, you're connected. You have so many people that love you, so many people that understand you, right? When you, moving forward now, what are the things that you find that binds you in your sobriety, any routines or daily habits, or, you know, because obviously we can't be in meetings all day, every day, right? We're still left to our own avails, you know, middle of the night, end of the day, you know, when we wake up in the morning, right? What things keep you going? What information or insight did you gather from your rehabilitation education that has been paramount to your success now?
Well, I consider this a blessing and a curse, which is that I don't have to work at this age. You know, they are now, but it means I've got a lot of time on my hands, and I'm very lucky. Across, been 3 days setting up my brain. Meditating, watching videos, learning some science, hearing people's stories, discussing their situation, discussing my situation. And a lot of it is a deep dive into who we want to be. What kind of life do we want to live? Let's take a look at that. Let's see, you know, do I want to disgrace myself? No. Do I want to throw things at people? No. Do I want to say mean things? No. I'm a really nice lady. So this is what I'm, you know, currently working on. But a big step too is learning to create new routines, because the old routines are gone. The kids are gone. You know, being empty nested, I don't have to make peanut butter and jelly sandwiches anymore. You know, how does my morning look? So I'm going to really work on that once this IOP is over. I don't ever be over. I tell them, no, you're never getting rid of me. But I make drinks. I make like blends and smoothies into them. And I walk my dog. I set my alarm clock now. I don't just sleep until I wake up. You know, I make sure I eat. Eating is huge. I would be hungry and think, oh, well, if I drink whiskey, I won't be hungry anymore and I'll get a buzz. Well, let's do that. I mean, that's, you know, if you're there, if you're listening and you're there, go to rehab. You need rehab. You know, find yourself a rehab and get in there and stay as long as you can. 30 days, 40 days, it seems like, oh my God, I can't do that. I can't possibly do that. But the longer you're there, the better. And all of this stuff, it's waiting for you when you come back. You know, it's not going anywhere. So I really treasure my experiences with both my rehabs. And I'm not even ashamed to say it. There are some people who said they've been there like 17 times. I don't even know if I believe that, but that's an incredible amount of time to be going back to rehabs. But every time they fall down, they get up and go back because they want to live a decent life, and they want a life. And this is what's important to me, is I want to remember, because my memory is not the greatest anyway. And then if you add a lot of alcohol to that, I'm not going to remember yesterday. I'm not going to remember the conversation I had. I'm going to start repeating myself. You know, I'm going to be annoying to people. So I want to remember. I want to do good deeds in the world. And try to help someone else, since I do have the time. I have the time. And travel, that's something I want to do for myself. I can't travel if I'm deep in my addiction. I've ruined a couple of trips by not being able to go because I couldn't pack after I paid for them. You know, it's been lots of ways that I've really screwed myself over.
Yeah. You know, the thing about, you know, the alcoholism again, is that this disease is so powerful. It's so cunning. And I think that a lot of people, when they see from the outside looking in, that are normies, right? When they see someone who is raging, right? They step away. They like just stay away from that person. They're, you know, they basically have gone crazy, and for lack of better terms, right? But the reality of it is that those people need so much love and help and support, right? You should be doing the opposite. You should be running towards them, right? Helping them get to the point of at least, you know, sober for a day, you know, and try to understand them. And because, yeah, there's usually trauma built into it that's gotten to that state, right? And there's also this element of mental health, right? I mean, we know that alcohol does what it does to the brain as it is, right? With lowering of dopamine receptors and just the inability to feel okay in a day basically gets wiped out with alcoholism, right? That's what the disease has done, right? We've tricked our body into giving it another source of dopamine, so it stops making its own. And then now without it, you can't function. Do you think that, because I think this is a circular problem, right? Some people say that it's the addiction causes the mental health issues, but also it's the mental health issues that cause the addiction. And for me, I know that without the saving grace of antidepressants, anti-anxiety medicines, I probably would have already relapsed. But that's one of the things that I knew that I was kind of teetering on with my struggle in life, was I knew that I had depression and anxiety issues, and I didn't know if it was purely chemically because of the fact of what I was doing to myself and my addictions, or was it something that was greater than the addiction and I was just simply trying to mask it. Did you find that, you know, obviously once the addiction, once the sobriety starts and the real you is there to process everything, did you find that there were definitely mental health things that you needed to deal with?
Yes, for sure. There's something that I don't want to miss to say, because you touched on it and I appreciate it very much. So before I answer your question, that is so important what you just said about not leaving the person, because the old way of thinking, well, first of all, the word alcoholic, that's a very old word. If to me, I couldn't own that word for the longest time. I didn't want to give it any power. To me, it was a 57-year-old man asleep on the lawn clutching a bottle of bourbon. Right. I was an alcoholic. Right. Now we don't call it that. Now we call it alcohol use disorder. It has a name. It has a name so that we can treat it, because it is a disease. It's not a moral decision. You know, you fall into it by accident or through trauma, and it responds to treatment. That is why they give it a code, because it responds to treatment. If my boyfriend would have left me, I think I would have died. And people were urging him, leave her, let her hit rock bottom, let her figure it out on her own. That is old school.
Yeah.
And that is risky, because I might not have woken up from one of those seizures. He got me in both those rehabs. He did the research because I wasn't capable of doing it. And my mother too. You know, I had two strong people working for me when I couldn't work for myself. So I had my own best friends, my own best girlfriends calling him up, leave her. And my boyfriend said, I'm not leaving her. And I, you know, will be forever grateful because I might owe him my life. I don't believe that we should be leaving people that sick.
Yeah.
Now, maybe we need to do whatever it takes to get him into rehab. Because I remember pushing back, on him, saying I'll go, and then getting in the moment. And no, I'm not going now. And he had to one time cry. He had to cry to get me there, but the tears got me. So there's all of that. And then going to your question, mental health, yeah, it was definitely a big part of how I got there. And then I'm still working on it as I'm coming out. I'm also using medications. I do believe that they are helping. I take a low dosage of Lexapro in the morning, which is an antidepressant. Half the world was on it during COVID. At least that's a joke a doctor made to me once. He said, what are your medications? And when I said Lexapro, he said, of course it is. We're all doing Lexapro now. But anyway, that and a low dosage of Seroquel in the evening, which has brought my sleep home to me. I can't sleep. I'm in that postmenopausal stage where I don't sleep well anyway. And then, you know, the alcohol would, of course, disrupt sleeping patterns. So I have that Seroquel that's a mood stabilizer and promotes sleep. And then I have my Lexapro in the morning. And I find I'm waking up much better. But, you know, I get out of bed right away. Before, I would try to stay in bed, largely because my boyfriend wanted me there. You know, he wanted a snuggle time. But he would be asleep and I'd be awake for 2 hours. And then that would just make the squirrels spin, you know. But getting up, getting going, set an alarm clock, get up, start your routine, whatever that is. Write it out, write it on a piece of paper. And another thing that we didn't touch on yet, which you may bring up, I think it's a good idea to make your list out ahead of time of things you can do when you're triggered. Because let's face it, everything's a trigger. Everything's a trigger, good or bad. Maybe having a bad moment and that's a trigger. You may have in a moment where you feel like, oh, I need to celebrate. That's a good moment. That's a trigger. It's glamorized on TV. It's glamorized through the holidays. It's glamorized on billboards. Those are triggers. Sometimes going to IOP, they're talking about it. I come out of there going, I'm kind of triggered right now. You know, but if you have your list ahead of time and make it as long as possible, like walking, biking, hiking, petting your dog, cleaning part of your garage, whatever, you know, make it as long. On one side, I have a list of things that I like to do for myself or should do for myself. Then on the other side, I'm working on a list. What can I do for others? And if I go through the list and none of it's working for me, then I'm going to see what I can do for someone else. Because 9 times out of 10, when I get out in society, I start to feel better because I'm a social person, you know, and I just, it just jogs me out of whatever, you know, downward thoughts I might be having. But the Lexapro and the Seroquel, they've been big help for me.
That's what I'm taking.
That stuff, but
yeah, I'm taking it, and I take actually an extended release Seroquel, which is supposed to kind of usually get tired around 3 or 4 hours after taking it, and it's usually holding me up until noon, and then I take a very small dose in the middle of the day just to kind of keep it going. But I found that, you know, it's a form of self care. I mean, absolutely right, getting yourself right. Because I mean, if you're not any good for anybody else, if you're not good for yourself, and I think that's a huge step. And a lot of people get afraid of that, right? Because they feel like it's selfish and people want to be giving, but it's okay to take time out for yourself, right? It's important. Just like the whole airplane, you know, analogy, right? You put your mask on first before you put it on the person next to you. Anything surprising you about sobriety that you're just like, hey, this is kind of cool. Anything or myths that you about sobriety that you want to squash because you just sit there and you had a notion about certain things before you got sober and now you're like, well, that just can't be farther from the truth.
Well, the myth, there is one myth, but I'm almost hesitant to say it because I don't want to encourage anyone down a path where they're using any substance at all, because really our best goal for anybody is to be as healthy as you can. And that would be eating right, sleeping right, and treating your neighbors right, you know. And really, if you don't have to take anything, that's best case scenario. But right. I do think this pickle cucumber thing, there may be somewhat of a myth there, because I feel like if you meet one alcoholic, you've met one alcoholic. We're not all alike, and all our needs are not alike, and all our treatment should not be alike, you know. And there are people who are really, really, really severe who can never, ever, ever take another drink without really going off the deep end. But there may be some people who can reset. And I say that very hesitantly because I don't want to encourage anyone to do that and then fail and wind up in a terrible situation. But I don't know, you know, I guess it just depends on how much of it is the physical gene, how much of it is trauma. For myself, my trauma is lessening. So I'm not going to predict the future. I'm only going to predict today. And today I'm going to be as well as I can be. And I can pretty much say I won't be getting there today.
One day at a time.
That's right. But will I ever have another drink of champagne at a wedding? I mean, I'm trying not to glamorize that because I know that trap. You know, I know that that's a trap. That's not good for me. But cross that bridge when we get to it. I'm still not convinced that I am. I don't know. I don't want to fall into any traps like I did before. I thought I had it before and I didn't. So I'm staying away from it as much as I can. But I mean, I'm not perfect. And it didn't lead me crazy, but you know, that's risky, you know.
Yeah. I think a lot of it is the time, right, in which you are sober, right, and the strength that you have and being able to be in social environments without the need to drink. I think that that's key. And I think that that as long as we have, like, all of our mooring lines, right, this ship is at dock, right, and if we have everything kind of attached. I had a great counselor who told me about this. He says, if you have all these ways in which you're tied to this dock, right, you have your sobriety understanding, right, you have your treatment, you have your community, you have all these things, right, that are holding you together, right, the urge is going to be minimal to non-existent. You won't ever feel the need to, right? And if, you know, as soon as those things start fraying away, maybe life gets busy and you can't go to as many meetings, or you feel like you're being triggered a lot. And we start deceiving ourselves. I think that's something that we have to watch for, because we've all tried it, right? I mean, I know I've tried it. I mean, I've tried it several times before I truly ever went into a treatment center. I mean, I was clean from alcohol for like 6 years, a couple times. And both times it was within a year, I had to basically put it away. And each time after that, it got progressively worse. The descent was much more violent, and it becomes scary, becomes very scary.
That is the riskiest part of it, is that they say you may have another relapse in you, but you don't know if you have another recovery in you.
Right, right. And that's what keeps me sober.
Yeah, but there are a couple of barometers that people can use. One is, are you drinking against your will? Do you not want to drink, but you're drinking anyway? If that's the case, then you're in addiction, right? That makes sense. And the other thing is, you can go have your blood work done, which I do regularly, and I have my AST and my, I think it's ALTs, my values looked at. And so they're still high, which means I can't be drinking because I'm going to go into the liver disease. Yeah. So, you know, just doing those two simple things, go check your liver. That'll tell you if you're drinking too much.
Yeah.
And if you're drinking against your will, then that's a huge red flag. And then the other thing is, healthy lifestyle is just the best there is. You won't feel any better than that. Once you really get there, like, I feel really good. I have energy. I have a memory right now. I can remember what I just said 5 minutes ago. you know, I can.
Yeah.
My window of tolerance is way bigger. I'm not so impatient and, you know, and I'm not raging at anybody. I'm still dealing with some anger issues because I'm so very disappointed with the way my family broke apart, but I'm more able to sit in discomfort than I previously was.
That's powerful.
I loved all. I had to learn about that.
Yeah, no, and I agree with you. So I'm at a point too where personally it's like I don't have anything that's driving me to need to feel better in any shape or way. And if I do, then I go straight to my psychiatrist so that, you know, maybe the meds aren't working like they were. Maybe, you know, and or maybe I need to talk to a psychologist. Maybe I need some more therapy. Maybe I need to sit with my community in IOP in the aftercare. Or maybe I need to call just simply a buddy who knows what this feels like and, you know, talk it out. But I feel like I'm personally way more present in life than I've ever been. And I think that that's a blessing too, right? It's because you're, and I'm excited about the things that are to come. And it's something that for the longest time, I never felt that way. It was just, I was trudging through life, carrying this bloody carcass we call a body and just waiting for the end. And it was very doomsday-ish, right?
I know. No, I get it because it would bring depression. I didn't realize how much depression I was causing myself. I knew I had it for legitimate reasons, but I was also causing myself a great deal of depression. And, you know, that's been a beautiful thing to say goodbye to.
Yeah. Okay, final question on my end. If you have anything else to add after this question, you feel free to knock it out of the park. But my biggest thing for you is that if you come across someone and they say, "Hey, I need some help," what would be your first recommendation to them?
I would invite them to sit down and talk with me. Hopefully we would be where there's a bench or a place where we could just sit down and let me get a little bit more information. And then I would more than likely try to talk them into a treatment center, depending on how severe, you know, their issues are. If you have any doubt in your mind, you cannot lose by going.
I
have just met the greatest people there, and I've learned so much about myself through other people. And, alcoholics are not losers or addicts. You know, they're not. These people that I've met have been the most sensitive, smart, intelligent, downright brainiacs, troubled for sure. All kinds of things have happened. But this is not just a room full of people who have no willpower and can't control themselves and just out to ruin their lives and everybody else's. That's not it. Yeah, I mean, I was so shocked at the greatest people that I met there over and over and over again. So smart. Some of them are so smart, I couldn't even carry a conversation with them because they were, you know, like the engineer intellectual types that I'd be just like, yeah, I'm like, I'm going to go over here and talk to this girl. but really beautiful people, soulful people, lovely people, just troubled. And we need them back in the world, like the real them. So, yeah, so if I ran into somebody who wanted to chat with me, I'd want to chat with them, too, because I have resources now that I know about that I could maybe offer up. And then the last thing that I'd love to say that someone said to me, and this is so true, somebody texted me, and they knew I was going on a trip. And this lady said, "Music, music, music. It is such a mood changer. And darn if it isn't." I mean, if I'm in a kind of a slumpy space, or, you know, maybe I'm by myself feeling a little blue, put on some music and put it on loud, stuff like that. Little things. Little things mean a lot. I loved that one. It's really helped me. Singing, dancing.
Yeah, well, I know you're a singer and a dancer. Yeah. So that's beautiful, Cheryl. Hey, you know what? And I got to tell you that just looking at you right now, I mean, you are glowing and life is good. You looks like you're just in a much better place. So I'm thankful for that. And I'm thankful that you made the decision, because I know that you've had a scary story. And I know now with all the education and the support that you are armed with, you know, even if, you know, heaven forbid there's another slip, right? I think you slip yourself right back into the sobriety. So with that, I have nothing else. Is there anything else you wanted to share?
No, I think we've covered about all of it.
Just
for anyone who's out there, you know, look out for yourself, take care of yourself. If you feel you need the help, don't be scared to, because a lot of times people are afraid to go and they don't know what they're going into. But everybody that's there has already walked that walk. They've already been through that. They know where you're at. So it's really, they're there. Most of the times I felt welcomed with open arms by most everybody I met.
Yeah.
So I would encourage people to, if they're thinking about it, if they think they need it, to do it, don't wait.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so very much, Cheryl. Again, this is Dusty with the Addicts Advocate. Please make sure you like and subscribe and keep following, because we have a ton of great empowering information out there that we love to share with you for those struggling as well as those in recovery. Okay. Thank you and have a great day. Bye-bye.
Bye.